This is Tuesday, August 15th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Coming up, the U.S. president does name names as he again rails against racism at a deadly protest in a U.S. college town. Also ahead, how has North Korea been able to make sizable improvements to its missile threat?
North Korea has always relied on imported engines. There are no, you know, we've seen no reports of indigenous manufacture or development of such capabilities.
That expert says he knows how and from where the DRPK's missile improvements came. And the top U.S. general visits China, where he signs a new agreement aimed at preventing a mistake that could lead to war on the Korean Peninsula, all on today's International Edition. President Donald Trump denounced neo-Nazis and the Ku Klux Klan as criminals and thugs Monday, following a firestorm of criticism to his initial reaction to a rally, which turned deadly in Virginia. One woman was killed Saturday in the city of Charlottesville when a car sped into a crowd of counter-protesters following violent clashes between white supremacists and opponents. The tragedy is renewing debate about the boundary between free speech and hate crimes, as VOA's Robert Rafel explains.
Monday at the White House, President Trump uttered words some say were 2 days too late.
Racism is evil. And those who cause violence in its name are criminals and thugs, including the KKK, neo-Nazis, white supremacists, and other hate groups that are repugnant to everything we hold dear as Americans.
Trump's televised comments followed bipartisan criticism of his initial remarks on Saturday, in which he condemned hatred and bigotry without specifying white supremacists and other groups who organized the rally. That protest erupted into hours of violence between organizers and opponents. 32-year-old Heather Heyer was among a group denouncing the protesters. She died when a speeding car struck the crowd. The driver, 20-year-old James Field Jr., was denied bail Monday. He faces second-degree murder and other charges. Civil rights advocates say determining when freedom of speech might incite violence is a major challenge for law enforcement and America's legal system. Laura Murphy is a free speech expert who served with the American Civil Liberties Union for nearly 20 years.
So it's very important to distinguish action from words. And the court has allowed very, very provocative, hateful words to be allowed to be said, because and I think that that's a good thing, because if people can't talk about it, they can't do anything about it.
Gabe Rotman is a national security and First Amendment expert.
The First Amendment means nothing if you can't speak safely, and it's incumbent on law enforcement not to shut down the speech if there's a chance for violence, but to step up the protection of both sides, to make sure that there's sufficient separation so that you can't have fists flying.
Marvin Heyer of the Simon Wiesenthal Center in Los Angeles says intolerance can spread from words to actions very quickly.
When we see that in broad daylight, here they are again, using the same terminology, we've got to marshal our forces, educational forces. We have to make sure that they don't get away with it, that in schools people know what to say, people know the history of Nazism.
The U.S. Justice Department has opened a civil rights investigation into Saturday's violence. Robert Rafel, VOA News, Washington.
As one might expect, this has all been a major target of people contributing to social media. That's why Andrew Palshevsky is here to tell us about it.
Well, there's been a lot of talk, and we've talked about it on the show in the past couple days, about President Trump's reaction on social media and reaction in these press conferences. But there's also been a lot of attention on the reaction of former President Obama, of course, the country's first African-American president, so someone that a lot of people have been looking to as these white supremacist rallies have gone on. And President Obama tweeted out a quote from Nelson Mandela. He said, "No one is born hating another person because of the color of his skin or the background or his religion." And President Obama included with this a photo where he's talking with three young children of different races sitting at the window of a building. This tweet, in just the past 3 days since it's been posted, is now one of the most popular tweets ever. It has more than 1 million retweets in less than 72 hours and more than 2.5 million likes. So a lot of people looking to President Obama, again, as the nation's first African-American president, to see his reaction to this. And this is what they're getting from his Twitter account. Mixed in with this reaction are reports also that the FBI and the Department of Homeland Security were warned and warned the White House about the potential threat of violence by white supremacists and extremists. And a lot of people on social media wondering why more wasn't done to try to prevent this ahead of the violence that happened in Charlottesville.
Well, really, what do you do? There was a very large police force standing by in Charlottesville. It was how they were situated, and the orders that they were given is under question, and the police chief has apologized. So, you know, we have to just see what happens, I guess. For and of course, there's probably going to be a next time, unfortunately.
And that's the reaction that we are seeing. People saying that there was that police presence, saying it's very hard to predict these incidents. Of course, the car attack that happened there, very difficult to try to predict and stop that. It's unfortunately happened in other parts of the world that have been under heightened security. And unfortunately, that's just what happened. But the other people saying, you know, President Trump has come out. He has spoken out and condemned these groups. What more does he need to do? And people saying that he's trying to do the best that he can in the position that he's in. Certainly his intention is to try to keep America safe.
Andrew Palcheski with a look at social media here on International Edition. Among the top stories in the world, President Trump denounces the white supremacists behind Saturday's deadly rally in Charlottesville, Virginia, saying their racism is evil. The Japanese prime minister says he and the U.S. president have agreed that stopping North Korea from launching nuclear missiles is their top priority. At least 300 people are now confirmed dead a day after the capital of Sierra Leone was buried under a mudslide and heavy flooding. Officials say that death toll is likely to rise. The former number two leader of Al-Shabaab says he has quit the Somalia-based militant group. Expanded coverage of these stories and more on the VOAnews.com website and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition, and this is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
According to the website water.org, 1 in 10 people in the world don't have access to safe water. It's common knowledge that drinking water that has been contaminated with harmful bacteria can make you quite sick. In areas of the world where there is little medical care, this could become a life or death situation. While there has been some success with chemical water treatment, such as adding chlorine to unclean water, bacteria has a way of building up a resistance to such efforts, making the little bugs hard to get rid of. Spanish researchers experimenting with self-propelled micromotors have developed tiny swimming robots that they say can detect and remove harmful bacteria from contaminated water without the need for chemicals or other potentially harmful elements. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Rapid progress in developing a long-range missile appears to have come after it refurbished rocket engines procured from a plant in the former Soviet Union. That is one of the findings of an investigation done by Michael Elliman, senior fellow for missile defense at the International Institute for Strategic Studies. He says the missiles used in recent North Korean tests were based on the RD-250 engine once made at a plant in what is now an independent Ukraine. Michael Elliman joins us now on International Edition. Mike, thanks so much for being with us. How did you reach this conclusion?
Well, it was really a process of elimination. We know from the past, North Korea has always relied on imported engines. There are no, you know, we've seen no reports of indigenous manufacture or development of such capabilities. And so in looking at the performance profile and the appearance of the engine, it was pretty easy to quickly narrow it down to the RD-250.
In what way?
Well, there's some unique features that only the RD-250 has, the way the turbopump is configured, and various elements along the nozzle, which is visible both in the ground tests and the flight tests that we've seen the North Koreans conduct. And there are a limited number of engines in the international, you know, that have been developed that actually look or hold these features. And there's only one that has the features and produces the 40 tons of thrust.
Why Ukraine? And what about Ukraine makes this a heavy possibility as far as you're concerned?
What makes the Ukraine and Yuzhnoye more likely is that a single chamber version of this engine has been seen at a university very nearby to the Yuzhnoye plant. It doesn't mean Yuzhnoye did it, but it increases the likelihood that that's where its origins.
So you are not saying that this is a decision by either the Ukrainian or Russian government to sell these missiles and missile parts to North Korea?
Far from it. In fact, I was quite clear in my writing that I do not think the Ukrainian government was responsible for this at all, and I certainly don't think the Russian government was responsible. I doubt either government knew about the transfers. This very clearly came through illicit arms markets and networks that North Korea has been known to use in the past. And with regard to Ukraine, it's important to note that the UN group that monitors North Korean sanctions had identified some North Koreans that had been trying to acquire technologies from Yuzhnoye. And the Ukrainian government arrested them in 2012, and I believe they're still in jail there. So it's clear to me that the Ukrainian government would not have sanctioned this sale at all, and it's unclear if executives at Yuzhnoye even knew about the sale. It's more likely this came from disgruntled employees or employees that were susceptible to bribery or some other form of corruption.
Well, you know, obviously, that a number of Ukrainian officials have strongly denied your allegations. And looking online, you have faced a storm of protest on Twitter overnight since your report came out saying you're on Russia's side in this issue and that you had worked for the Russian government. What's your reaction to that?
Well, I certainly never worked for the Russian government. I worked on a U.S. government-funded program in Russia to help the Russian government eliminate its excess long-range missiles and chemical weapons and other projects related to cooperative threat reduction. I also worked in Ukraine, where there's the dismantlement of several ICBMs. Those projects are done except for the SS-24, which continues at a plant in Pavlograd.
Michael Elliman is Senior Fellow for Missile Defense at the International Institute for Strategic Studies. Mike, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
The top U.S. general, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Joe Dunford, is in Beijing today, meeting with his Chinese counterpart. Two generals signed an agreement that will improve communication between the United States and Chinese militaries and lessen the chances of miscalculations amid high tensions on the Korean Peninsula. VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb is traveling with General Dunford. She joins us now from Beijing. Tell us more about this agreement, Carla.
Well, this agreement is kind of the result from the talks that President Trump and President Xi had earlier this year. Back during that time, they decided that they needed to keep the communication lines going in the event of just benefiting on several different levels. There's the diplomatic level, the security level, economic level, and even the cyber and social level. So today's signing, what the U.S. military and what the Chinese military are hoping is that this is going to create that mechanism, hold the first talks, which will be in November in D.C., and that will be among the J5, which is for strategic planning in the U.S. military at the Pentagon, and then the equivalent with the Chinese military. And they're hoping that through that, if they can work together, not necessarily cooperating, but coordinating and making sure that both sides know what they're doing, then there won't be that chance for miscalculation in the event that something horrible happens on the Korean Peninsula or that Korea North Korea continues to act in this negative behavior.
During the trip, we know that General Dunford stopped first in Korea and then went on to China. What has been the tenor of the talks? What have been the aim of why this trip is taking place?
Well, this trip is very important to the entire region because the entire region is on high alert right now. You have in South Korea, Secretary Mattis, Secretary Tillerson send an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal reassuring the allies. Chairman Dunford, who I'm traveling with, was reassuring the South Korean allies, saying that we're there for you. They discussed ways that they could coordinate. They talked about how the United States could respond in the event of a crisis. He's probably going to do the same thing while he's in Tokyo, speaking with his Japanese counterparts. And then in China, it's a little different shift because the Chinese are not thrilled of the U.S. presence on the Korean Peninsula. They're not thrilled that the U.S. has deployed part of its missile deterrent, THAAD, to the region. So they need to be reassured as well that all the steps that the United States are taking are not geared in any way to be against China. It's purely defensive in nature. And so I think that point was really hammered down today.
Carla Babb is VOA's Pentagon correspondent, traveling through Asia with the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Carla, thanks so much for being with us. North Korean leader Kim Jong-un has appeared to postpone a plan to fire missiles toward Guam, a move that could help defuse the potential for imminent conflict and give new momentum to reported behind-the-scenes efforts underway to find a peaceful resolution to the nuclear crisis on the Korean Peninsula. President Trump's harsh warning last week that the U.S. would respond to any North Korean threat with fire and fury set off a flurry of confrontational rhetoric from both sides. The North Korean People's Army pushed back, saying preparations were underway to launch a missile over Japan to land near the U.S. territory of Guam. Trump said the U.S. military was locked and loaded and ready to respond to any attack on its territories. This is VOA.
Hello, sports fans. This is Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports. For detailed information about your favorite sports, visit our website, voaafrica.com. And if you want to chat with me and sports fans in Africa and all over the world, visit my Sunny Side of Sports Facebook page. There, the sports talk never stops. So come on, join the action with the Sunny Side of Sports.
Hello, Africa. This is Peter Clotty, host of VOA's Africa Weekend show, Nightline Africa. Tune in. You will be glad you did.
Nightline Africa is a fast-paced, tightly edited news show designed to keep our listeners engaged from beginning to end. Nightline comes to you live from the Voice of America on the following shortwave frequencies: 6080 kilohertz, 49.3 meter band, and 15580 kilohertz, 19.2 meter band.
International Edition continues from VOA. This year marks 40 years since the legendary King of Rock and Roll, Elvis Presley, died at his home in Memphis at the age of 42. As VOA's David Byrd tells us, fans across the world are remembering Presley, one of the pioneers of rock music.
Well, since my baby left me, well, I found a new place to dwell. Well, it's down at the end of Lonely Street, that heartbreak hotel.
Elvis Presley took the world by storm in the 1950s, shaking and gyrating on stage, melting girls' hearts with his charismatic good looks and his curled upper lip. Elvis was born into poverty in Tupelo, Mississippi, but rose to stardom on the heels of songs like Heartbreak Hotel, Hound Dog, Blue Suede Shoes, and Love Me Tender. Elvis died of complications from drug use and heart problems on August 16, 1977. Since his death, fans have flocked to his Graceland mansion in Memphis to pay tribute to their hero. This year, fans will be able to pay nearly $29 to join the procession to the Presley family gravesite. They will also get a glimpse of the newly built entertainment complex, which replaced older exhibits featuring Elvis's cars, costumes, and memorabilia. Angela Toe is a tourist from Michigan.
It is really about the music. You know, he had so many influences. It just wasn't rock music, but it was R&B, it was blues, and he fused that naturally.
Molly Kindle and her family drove hours to see the mansion and to pay tribute to Presley.
It's crazy how busy this place is today, 40 years later. I think we probably took 4 hours to get through this tour today because of all the people. It was really nice.
Well, it's one for the morning, two for the show, three to get ready, and I go.
In Manila, the Philippines, several Elvis impersonators took to the stage to pay tribute to the music legend. Eddie Lombardo is the Elvis of Italy.
We're not trying to duplicate Elvis, because nobody can be Elvis. There's only one Elvis, you know. And well, we're trying to bring the memory of Elvis back to people. That's basically what we're doing.
Douglas Masuda, the self-described Elvis of Japan, says he hopes to communicate the spirit of Presley's music.
So you say, well, how do I feel, you know, when I sing? Well, I'm not Elvis. I don't look like Elvis. I probably don't sound like him, but I feel his song. So if I feel it, you feel it.
Bam Angping is described as a young Elvis sensation. He says that Presley was a groundbreaker for generations of artists.
Elvis kind of like banged down the door because everyone was so conservative before. You had Frank Sinatra, like you said. They were all so conservative, and then there's this guy shaking his hips. So that started everything, I think, for everyone.
Elvis Presley ranked fourth in Forbes magazine's 2016 list of top-earning dead celebrities. That's not bad, but it paled compared to another king, King of Pop Michael Jackson, who earned $825 million last year. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
That's going to wrap things up for us. You've been listening to International Edition. Find us at voanews.com. You can like us if you'd like us to like us at VOA Now. Follow us on Twitter at VOA_IE. Thanks to our director, Patrice Martin, our engineer, Thomas Blondet. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Enjoy your day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Virtually every state in the Western Balkans has recently held free and fair national elections, with the participation of all political parties and with results that reflected the will of the people. This is a historic accomplishment, said Vice President Mike Pence on a recent visit to Montenegro. He urged leaders in the region to make the most of this moment. You have the opportunity to settle grievances of the past and bring people of different backgrounds and beliefs together in pursuit of the common good, said Vice President Pence. You can strengthen your economies and open the pathway to prosperity for your people through tax and regulatory reform. You can tackle corruption and build accountable and transparent governments, which will deliver on the highest aspirations of your people and build confidence among those who would invest in the prosperity of your future. The United States will continue to support the Western Balkan countries as they take steps toward good government, democratic reform, and the rule of law. The United States will also partner with individuals to foster civil society, a free and independent press, and an economy that opens opportunity for all who seek it. The U.S. will continue to support the Dayton Accords and the principles they represent, as is committed to dialogue between Serbia and Kosovo to fully normalize relations between them. Vice President Pence stressed that security is the foundation of prosperity. For that reason, we'll continue to build your capability to operate alongside NATO and other Western forces. But as President Donald Trump has made clear, all who wish to join the NATO alliance must meet the minimum commitment of spending at least 2% of gross domestic product on their own national defense. This investment, said Vice President Pence, is necessary to keep our solemn pledge that an attack on one is an attack on all. A commitment to democratic values and to NATO will lay the foundation for lasting prosperity and security. As Vice President Pence said, "Ours is a shared future of liberty and freedom. United in this great community of nations, I know we'll face that future together, as allies and friends."
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.